Jerry Alvarelli interviewing Pedro Velazquez. Today is March 4th, 1992, and this interview is in Pleasant Grove City. Now you say something.
Hello, this is Pedro Velazquez being interviewed by Jerry Alvarelli, March 4th, 1992. It's 2:29 p.m. We're in some building at Columbia University.
Locked in. You should start by telling me about your childhood, where you grew up, and your family and relationships with your family. Where are you born?
Oh, it's going.
It's going.
I was born and raised in Puerto Rico. I was born in the town of Humacao, and I was raised in Bayamón. I have was born out of a very dysfunctional family. I have a mother who separated from my father 18 times during the time I was growing up. I have two sisters. One of them is a lesbian. The other one's straight. But nobody's perfect, so I don't blame her for that. And I was raised in different public projects in Puerto Rico. When I was about 14 or 15, I left home, and I went to live with the pastor of my church. I have been attending a Pentecostal church since I was a little kid, because I was brought there by my family, by my mother. About 14 or 15, I moved in with the pastor of my church. I left my home. I left my home because supposedly my mother was in a relationship with a guy outside of her marriage. And supposedly this was a sin, so I had to get out of there, you know, so my mother could see the way of the Lord, you know, and all the other bullshit. And I moved in with the pastor of the church, who happened to be a gay man, who was married, who had kids. And he was my first sexual experience with a man. After that, let me see, I went to college. In college, that's when I met my lover, the lover that I have now.
Where did you go to college?
The University of Puerto Rico in Rio Piedras. I went away to school, and that's where I discovered that gay sex, and discovered that I could be gay and be proud, you know, and be a normal person. Because at that point, really, I thought that gay was something really crazy, and I really didn't want any part of it, you know. I mean, other than the sex, you know. But I was thinking I was gonna live up to be and get married and all the other stuff, and then do the gay thing on the side, you know. And let me see. The University of Puerto Rico, I met my lover. We have been together for 8 years now. I wasn't doing anything there, you know. I was jumping from concentration to concentration in terms of studies. So I didn't finish anything there. I did about 3 years of college there, and then I came to New York. Came to New York, did some jobs.
What year was that?
84. I did all kinds of jobs. I worked in a moving company. I did dishes. I worked as a real estate salesman. I did jewelry, the elevator. Yeah, I did the elevator and a prostitution place. And it was a prostitution hotel, the St. James Hotel on 45th Street. I did the elevator there for a few nights. I worked as a jewelry salesman. I worked as a credit person. I did a lot of shit, you know, working in a factory. That was the first job I took when I got here. And then I saw the ad for the police department on the train, for the test for the police department. And I mean, with the education that I have, and that was the best job that I could get in terms of money and in terms of benefits. So I went for it. The test in October 84. Let's see. Yeah, October 84. And then in July 85, I went to the academy. So going through the psychological and medical and the investigation and all the other shit that they put you through. Oh, the academy was fun. The academy was a lot of fun. Actually, I had a little trouble in the academy because I had been here recently from Puerto Rico, so my my language skills weren't that good. I wasn't as fluent as I am now. I'm not that fluent now, so imagine what how bad I was then. When I first came here, when you first came here, come here from Puerto Rico, there you pretty much learn the language. You learn how to write it and you learn how to read it. But because you never have any conversational English classes, you know, it's very difficult to when you come here. It took me about a year before I really got fluent. So when I was going through the academy, I had a really heavy accent, and I was really afraid, you know, to say anything in class because I knew the guys were gonna start joking about my accent, and I also, I didn't want to look stupid or sound stupid, so I didn't say a word to the whole academy. I did pretty good in my classes, but all the instructors wrote down on my evaluation that I never said anything in class. And that was my only fault in the academy. But I enjoyed myself a lot.
What was fun?
There was a sense of camaraderie, you know. Everybody would go out, drink together, have fun together, you know. We looked out for each other, you know. We talked about how we thought it was going to be once we came out of the academy. It was nothing like the way we thought it was going to be, but, you know, we would talk about our expectations about the job and about life and everything else, you know. Go down to the seaport every Friday, get drunk, get thrown out of the place. It was a fun time, the academy. The classes that you take, when you go through the range for the shooting classes and when you go for the driving classes, and it was very exciting. There's something very near to me.
So, what year did you get out of the
academy? I came out of the academy in December 85. Then I went into the Transit Academy. I was there for a month because you're supposed to learn all the other stuff of the subway, you know, like how to turn the power off, you know, when somebody's in the tracks, or how to handle an emergency, like when somebody gets pushed, or how to evacuate a train. All the other things that city cops don't learn because they don't work in the subway that we have to learn.
So when did you know that you're
I found out before I went into the academy, the day that they call you for the swearing-in ceremony, that's the day I found out. They told me that I was going to be transit. I didn't have a fucking idea what transit was. You know, I thought transit was going to be like, what I was thinking about transit was the guys that work in highways, you know, highway unit. I was thinking transit though, because I was, you know, translating in Spanish in my mind. And in Spanish, transito would be highway type of work. And that's what I thought I was going to be doing. And I noticed that other people around me were like disappointed, really disappointed. And they were cursing, and there was one woman that was crying. And I go, well, what's so wrong about in transit? And then they tell me that I was going to be in the subways, you know, for the next 20 years. Oh, shit. You know, I couldn't believe it.
Do you still feel that way, or would you rather be?
Oh, no, I love my job. I love transit now. But, as a matter of fact, I'm going through the lateral transfer process now. I'm going to go into the city police department. Not because I don't like the transit police department, but I do enjoy my job, and I like it a lot. But the challenge is out. It's already gone, you know. I mean, I'm already there. I have been there for 7 years. It's going to be 7 years in August, not in July. And I really could go for another job, you know what I mean? I really wanted to get out of New York City altogether, go somewhere else, but my lover doesn't want to go, so I can't.
Mm-hmm. So, when did you come out, or you didn't come out on the job right away?
No. I waited until by the time I finished my probation, that's when I came out. I was afraid that I was going to get my ass fired, you know, if I did. And I was also afraid, you know. I don't think I was ready when I first came on the job to come out. I don't think I would have done it then. Later on, when I get into goal, you know, and start, even though I came out before joining goal, but You know, once I get to New York.
You came out on the job or something?
Yeah. Once I get on the job and I start, once I come to New York and I start reading all the gay papers and all the other stuff, that's when I started developing a sense of pride, you know, and I started realizing that it wasn't that bad, you know, being gay. Mm-hmm. I was going to be able to live with it, you know. And I slowly came out, I first came out to my study partner. He transferred out of the unit. He went to another unit. He couldn't take it. And then I started coming out to people, you know, slowly. I remember that it was very difficult to come out to people. Like, first, it was very difficult to come out to anybody. When I started coming out to people, it got easier, you know, to come out one-on-one. And then it was difficult to come out to people in a group. And then it got easier, you know. It's like a process. Like, you know, like say there are five or six guys, you know, we're talking about whatever, you know. and the conversation goes to, I'm going out with this girl, whatever, you know, and I want to be part of the conversation. So I would say something like, well, yeah, I met this guy, you know, really cute or something like that, you know. You know what I mean? I mean, normal part of the conversation, you know, like before I wouldn't say anything. I would just be quiet. Everybody else would be talking. But like now I say, oh yeah, I met this cute guy in the train the other day, you know, got his number and stuff like that. And, oh, right now they're so used to it, they don't, it's like nothing, you know, it's like part of the conversation. A couple of years back, forget it, it was like, ooh, what the fuck is he talking about, you know? I mean, I still get that reaction from people that don't know me, you know, like from people from other units or new people in the district that come to work.
So what was it like when, before you came out and you weren't saying anything?
How did I feel?
Yeah, how did you feel?
It was frustrating, you know, because I was like in fear all the time. It was like a fear, constant fear, you know, of being found out and a fear of being rejected, you know. I mean, it's like, I knew that I wasn't going to be one of the boys like I was, you know, once they found out I was gay. I mean, and that is the truth. I mean, I'll never be one of the boys, you know what I mean? I mean, I can get invited to go to bars and drink once in a while. Once in a blue moon, I do get invited by my peers to go drink or somebody's birthday or whatever, something like that, you know. But I'm not one of the boys. I mean,
but you were.
I was then. Yeah. I mean, we'll go out drinking and we'll go out to dinner with the guys, you know, and go to the nudie bars and topless bars and shit like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I would go. You know, we'll sit there and watch, you know. I wouldn't make the comments that they made. Oh, if I catch her, I'll do her or something like that. But, you know, I will sit there and, you know, and go with them and play the part, you know.
So what made you come out?
What made me come out? Well, it's really, you know, I was tired already of all the, once you start learning about the gay community and about the history and about the, who you are and who you can be, you know, how you're protected by the law here in New York City, and you know, there's really no need for all the line and all the other stuff. And you start realizing that you don't have to do it anymore, you just don't have to. And when you work with somebody, you know, like I had a study, semi-study partner, you know, this guy, we worked together for 8.5 hours a day, you know. It's very difficult not to share with that person in your life, you know, because we talk about everything. I mean, you have 8 hours to talk and to work and to, and the time that you're not working, you're talking. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult not to share your life with this person. So I finally did tell him, you know, that I was gay and I had a lover and all the other stuff. And he kind of knew, you know. I mean, we've been together, working together for all this time, and I wasn't playing the game anymore. You know, I wasn't substituting her for him. You know, or any of that stuff. So he finally realized. Say it again?
That was enough to make a master transfer, just that you weren't playing the game.
Yeah. It was very difficult for him because I told him that I was going to be, I was going to come out to other people, you know, I was going to just, this was like the first step, and I was going to tell everybody, you know, slowly, eventually. So, you know, it's very difficult for him to be working with a gay man, you know, because he was probably worried about his reputation and what people were going to think about him. And stuff like that, you know. I can't blame him. I really don't blame him, you know.
Did he tell other people?
Yeah, he did. He told some people, too.
So it must have been hard in the beginning.
It was a little hard, you know, I mean. But I knew that was the price I was going to pay, you know. I mean, I knew that I wasn't going to be one of the boys, and I knew that I was going to lose some of the standing that I already had, you know. So I saw a comment and I took it when it came. Right now I talk about it and I say, yeah, it was difficult, and I just dismiss it like that, but it was more elaborate than that. You know, I was into a couple of fist fights with people. Once I come out, you know, some people took it to made the decision that we're gonna fucking make my life fucking miserable, you know. I had this guy who works in the Rolco area. And the person that works Rolco has a lot of power, you know, over days off that you take, over assignments, over everything, you know, because they prepare the Rolco. This guy decided he was gonna make my life miserable, you know. And when I would call the district for whatever information that I needed, he would hang up on me and shit like that. And one day he called me in a bad mood. And he hung up on me too many times, you know. And he hangs up on me, you know. Just as soon as he heard my, as soon as I said something, I knew he answered, you know, by his name. Hangs up the phone on me, you know. And I said, this motherfucker's gonna hear me when I go back to the district, you know. So I called back again because I had to give him a number from the complaint number that I report that I was doing. He does the same thing again. I just couldn't take it. I fucking blew my top off. I went straight to the district. And I went behind the desk where he was sitting. He was sitting down. And I said, what's your fucking problem with me, man? And he got up. He's a tall guy. He's taller than me. He's fat, too. He said, I don't have a fucking problem with you. And he starts pushing me with his belly, right? So, I pop him right in the face. I hit him right in the face. Pop, on the side of the face. And he hits me back, you know. We just kept hitting each other. We got separated by the desk sergeant and by some of the people that were there, you know. And I got a complaint. He got a complaint. They shit canned the complaint, but I could have been in a lot of trouble because not only I came out of my post, you know, I left my post unattended. I went behind the desk, which is a restricted area for everybody, because I hit him first, you know. And there were witnesses to that. The sergeant was saying, "He hit him first. He hit him first." You know, so. But I was in another fight after that. I was in a fight with another guy. This guy didn't want to work with me, right? But then he couldn't say that he didn't want to work with me because he would have to go to the sergeant and tell him he don't want to work with me. The sergeant would say, well, you don't want to work with him, because it's a fact. He can't say that, you see? Mm-hmm. Because then the sergeant has to force him to work with me. And We were on plain clothes, you know, when we're on plain clothes that day. And he's like really pissed off talking to me like I'm dirt, you know. And I say, what is the fucking problem, man? What, you have a problem? You know, you want to talk about it? I said, no, I don't want to talk about it, you fucking dirty fag or something like that. And I said, man, if you don't want to work with me, just don't work with me, you know. Just have somebody else work with me. And see, it starts cursing at me, la 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 la. You want to fight me? He tells me, you want to fight me? I said, yeah, I'll fucking fight you. So, it's really stupid, you know, really childish, you know. And we're going through this fucking, it's funny because in order to fight and not cause any problems, you know, to any of us, we have to go into a room in the subway. So he's trying to open this room and he doesn't have the key for the room. And he tells me, you have the key for the room? And I say, yeah, I have the key for the room. So I go and open the room. And we get in there, you know, take our coats off, we start hitting each other. And there was a cabinet with those neon lights, and neon bulbs. And we're fighting, we're pushing each other, and we hit that thing. and the whole cabinet fell. You could hear you could hear all the bulbs, you know, exploding inside the thing. Boom, 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 boom. Anyway, we ended up like in a gridlock, you know, and guess what happened? After we fight, he's like, you want a beer? So we went and had a beer, you know, and since that day, we're like the best friends, you know.
Friends?
Yeah, I mean, he always looked at me with kind of a respect, you know. It's just that these people have all these stereotypes in their minds, you know, that gay people are like this or like that, and we're weak and we're stupid, and we're going to take whatever they do, because they have been hitting gay kids all their lives, you know, since they were in school, they were bullies, you know, hitting on gay kids. And somehow, you know, the stupid mentality is like, he proved himself, now he's cool, you know, some shit like that, you know. I don't know how the mentality works, but that's the way it goes. I have had other experiences, you know, where you know, people where I get into arguments, you know, loud arguments, and sometimes even into blows, you know, close to blows, you know. And the reason they never got into blows is because there were all the people there, and I'm separated, pretty much separated. Like when the Irish the ACT UP went into the St. Patrick's Cathedral, somebody at work came and asked me, so what do you think about the St. Patrick's Cathedral thing? I said, well, they had a right to be there, you know. I mean, gay people were Catholic too, you know, and the cardinal has been blasting us, and he's been spewing homophobia, you know. He's been creating this climate where it's easier to bash gay people, you know, and it's his fault, you know. A lot of people are losing their lives and are getting bashed because of what this guy says, you know. And he's a fucking asshole. You know, I mean, I wasn't saying it like this. I was saying it, you know, cursing and everything, because I was pissed off. And some guy from the back, oh, shut up, you fucking faggot, you motherfucker. And he comes running at me, you know. And I see him coming, so I'm going towards him. And we got separated, you know. It didn't get to the point where we got into blows or anything like that.
Uh-huh. But a lot of cops were upset about
that. Oh, they were very upset. They were very upset, and I was the only one there to take their anger, you know. So pretty much, that was a shitty week, you know. I get into a lot of arguments, and a lot of people treated me like shit that week, you know, because I'm the gay man of the district. I mean, there's plenty of gay people in my district, but I'm the one who's out, you know. So I'm like the symbol of the gay community there. And I was the one who was taking all the shit that week because of... every time something happens, I'm the one who takes all the shit, you know. Like St. Patrick's or the Gay Pride Day Parade, you know, where they start talking. It's like the homophobia goes up, you know, whenever there's a big gay activity or big gay demonstration. Like the ACT UP demonstration at Grand Central, you know, which I covered, I was working there that day. So, you know, but I'm used to it already, and it doesn't bother me.
What did they say, do you remember, about that demonstration?
Oh, that demonstration, we weren't doing roll call before the demonstration, and I asked the sergeant that I wanted to address the guys, you know. And I got up in front on the roll call, and I said, listen, this is the situation. You have a lot of people that are going there who have lost their parents, you know, their lovers. They have lost people to AIDS. You know, there's people that are very angry, and people that have a gripe with the government. You know, what you're gonna have to do there, you know, is just be calm. You know, be collected. Don't even think about saying the word fag, because you're gonna get a complaint. You know, I mean, they know the process. You know, and you will get a complaint. So just be cool, be collected, you know, let them do the thing. And they're not going to attack you, or they're not going to throw urine at your face, or they're going to do any of that shit that people say they do, because they don't. I know most of these people are going to be there. And fucking Lieutenant Alexander Rocco says, well, be careful, because I heard that they take blood from HIV people and they throw it at the cops' faces. I said, no, that's not true. That would never happen. They would never do something like that. That's totally untrue. And he was like pissed off at me for about a month after that. And you know, things like that. After the demonstration, they really didn't come down on the subway, you know, so it wasn't much of a flag. The demonstration was mostly done upstairs and on the street, so I didn't get much of a hard time with that. But, you know, still it wasn't the same as any other week.
Mm-hmm. And they make little asides and little comments during the demonstration?
No, nothing that I saw. No.
But talk about maybe because homophobia they knew. That's not necessarily directed toward you.
From the police?
Yeah, that you heard before you came out or
since? Well, there are homophobic cops out there, you know, that will take use every opportunity to bash a gay person, you know. Not only physically, but verbally, you know. And through intimidation, you know, things like that. So I know that about guys that have been given complaints because they say fag to somebody or something like that. Mm-hmm. Well, issuing a summons or they would just somebody would pass by and they say they fucking faggot or something like that, and they would get complaints. Happens, you know. Cops abuse their power. They abuse against gay people. They abuse it against people of color. You know, happens a lot. I have never witnessed any gay bashing by cops, you know. And if I did, I wouldn't just stand there and do nothing about it, you know. I would get involved. I have never witnessed it, maybe because I know I'm gay and nobody would do it in front of me. But I don't know, the people that I know a few people that I would be capable of doing something like that. I know people that I know would definitely bash a gay person if they had the chance, you know. But it's never been done in front of me, you know. Mm-hmm. And as far as I know, it's never been done in my district to anybody that had reported it, you know. So mm-hmm. I have made a complaint.
You told me once about, I think a secretary who worked in your district and mm-hmm. told her that she shouldn't talk to you.
Oh, yeah. There's a secretary, her name is Imelda, and she's like a born-again Christian religious freak type of thing. And when I was going through a really hard time when I first came out, that I was really getting a lot of shit. She was the only one who would talk to me and be friendly to me and you know, have a conversation to me. And people started putting pressure on her. Somebody told her that she shouldn't talk to me because if nobody would talk to me, I would leave. Because I wouldn't have anybody to talk to, you know. And she said no, you know. She just kept talking to me and being my friend. And now that things are normal, she's still my friend, you know. And her idea is another totally different idea. I mean, the reason she talks to me and is nice to me is because the Lord put her there, you know, to convert me into the Christian, ways, you know, and the Lord is going to change me and all the other bullshit, you know. So that's her whole idea of talking to me and being nice to me and all the other stuff, you know. But it was appreciated and it was welcome, you know, because when you're by yourself and you have, everybody's pretty much on your ass to harassing you, you know, it's good to have somebody there. So it was welcome. She's still my friend to this day.
So what do you like about it?
What do I like? I like having a gun, not having to worry much about. Even though it's perception, because people that have guns get shot more than people that don't have guns. I like having a gun, walking around with a gun, you know, because I feel safe, I feel secure. I don't understand how people that don't have guns live in this city, you know, with all the crime and everything. I like the benefits. The money's good. The advantages of the job are good, you know, such as being a sexual symbol for. Oh, I'm not supposed to say this. being a you know, gay people, yeah, straight people too, you know. I mean, I had the same sexual opportunities that my heterosexual counterparts have, you know, with women. Cops do a lot of extracurricular activities, you know, and me being gay, you know, it's the same. I do have get my numbers and have my encounters and stuff, and that's the best part of the job. kind of. I like the part, you know, where I know that I treat people decently, and I like that. And the way I look at it is that if there was somebody else in my position, you know, if I didn't have that job, this job, and I was a shoe salesman or whatever, you know, whatever I wanted to be, there would be another cop in that position that probably would be nasty to people, you know, because there are a lot of cops out there that are really nasty to people and treat people like shit. And me being here, I like it because I knew that I'm treating this person differently than most other people would. So, you know, that makes me feel good. Like, I answer people's questions, you know, when there's a crisis, I treat people with really a lot of care. I treat them real decent. And I know that people wouldn't get the same treatment from everybody, the treatment they get from me, so that makes me feel good, you know. Mm-hmm. Makes me feel good that I'm here. Whenever you get to do something for people, like save somebody's life or something like that, it really makes you feel good. I was in Grand Central a couple of years back, and this guy, there was an old man, it was a male black, about 75, he was having a heart attack upstairs. And people started, you know, calling for the cops. Nobody knew what to do. I heard the people screaming, and I go upstairs, and there he's on the floor, you know. And I started giving him CPR and mouth to mouth. He wasn't breathing. Didn't have a pulse. So I started giving him CPR mouth to mouth. A nurse that was in the crowd helped me. He was helping me with the chest. And between the two of us, we got him back. You know, by the time EMS got there, he was back breathing, and he had a pulse. His heart was pumping again. And, you know, things like that make you feel good. When I got up from the floor, everybody started clapping, and it was like performing. I don't know. It was it makes you feel good. You know, you save somebody's life. It makes you feel good when you find a kid. You know, like when this happens often, you know, parents get separated from the kids. Just the day before yesterday, I had two of those in one day, and the first thing that goes through the parents' mind is that the kid is gonna get raped and killed and cut into pieces and thrown into a garbage can, you know, because they immediately think that the worst thing is going to happen, you know. And I usually get to the scene and I calm them down, you know, make them feel better. And I'm 99% of the time, I mean, we find the kid within the hour, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's a good feeling too, you know, when you're reunited mothers and kids, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the day before yesterday, I had two of those, you know, two separated youth, so it makes you feel good when you're doing something like that. It makes you feel good when you help these people get together, you know.
When did you join GOAL? How did you hear about GOAL?
How did I hear about GOAL? Pretty much in the magazines and the stuff that I read, that I was reading. Because I started subscribing to lesbian and gay magazines like The Advocate and The Native back then. I don't read The Native now, but back then I used to, because it was the only thing in New York. That's where I learned about the Gay Officers Action League. I kept putting it off, and I really wanted to join all this time, but I just kept putting it off and putting it off until I finally showed up for a meeting one day. And those days, they were really closeted, and they were really careful who came to the meetings, and they would ask people to see their IDs and things like that. You know, they had a sergeant at arms, and the sergeant at arms would be at the door, and nobody would go in that he didn't know or he didn't prove. I showed my ID from the transit police, and the next week. I filled out my application. The next week, they had like a screening committee. They made me sit in front of like six or seven guys, and they were all asking me questions, you know. And they really wanted to know that I was legit, that I wasn't part of ID or anything like that. And they were a little paranoid, you know, that we're gonna get infiltrated by the internal affairs of the police department. It was their own fears, you know. I don't think it was as much as reality as it was their own fears. most of these people that were interviewing me, not most of them, all of them were in the closet. So, you know, they're really protecting their own closets, you know. And at that time that I came into cold, the whole board of cold was closeted. So you can imagine how effective they were. They didn't have a face, they didn't have a voice, you know. Sam Chacon and Charlie, what's his name? Huh? Charlie Cochrane were not there anymore, though. They both had moved on. And so you can imagine how ineffective the organization was. When that meeting, I pretty much came out to them as a radical, kind of, because at that time I was out of the closet already. Was I out of the closet? Yeah, it was. I was out of the closet. I'm kind of proud, because I remember telling them that I would represent Gold on transit, you know. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, that'd be nice, we don't have anybody in transit, you know. They did have a few transit members, and nobody was out of the closet. And then, a few months later, this guy, Sam Chacon, who was one of the founders, shows up for a meeting. And he's saying all these things, you know, the guy's talking in the meeting, and I'm saying, wow, look at this guy, I want to meet this guy. He was really well-spoken, and he had a lot of good ideas, you know, about the organization and how to move things along, you know, how to get the organization from the closet into a mainstream lesbian and gay organization. And he did. I met Sam and a few like-minded people, Sam, me, and others. We decided to. You got Edgar Rodriguez, Luis Gomez, Vanessa Ferro, and a few other people. We decided to take over the organization. We did hostile takeover. Hostile takeover. Mm-hmm. Not really. We run for the post, you know, for the board, mm-hmm. And we would prepare nice campaigns, you know, send literature to everybody. So we. Pretty much took over the board, and the board went from being a closeted board to be an openly lesbian and gay proud board. And this board, of course, was more effective, you know. We started getting invitations from organizations, we started going into the police department and being on their face, you know, and they know this is what we want, and we're not going to allow any discrimination. Whenever some discrimination would come out against one of our members, we would be there for them, you know, something that wasn't never happened before. We used to have a lot of people jobs, you know. A lot of guys that were being put on the, they were going to get fired, you know, because of whatever things that they did. And we able to save the jobs, you know. I'm sure that most of them were being fired because they were gay, you know. Mm-hmm. They were being, they were getting a punishment.
Remember?
Yeah. Let me see, like, we had this guy, this cop, one of our cops, who was gay, he was found in a car with his lover, right? His lover was smoking a joint when he was caught by the, it was in Nassau County, it happened in Nassau County, the cop is a city cop. And his lover was really, really effeminate, you know. And the cops right away realized that these two guys were a couple, you know. And they arrested our guy, you know. The job here in New York was getting ready to fire his ass for this. We were able to document cases of the same situation, but with a straight couple. And those instances, the guy got 30, some of them got 60 days, you know, suspension, but they weren't fired. Now here we have this gay couple, you know. And they want to fire this gay cop, so we didn't allow it to happen. You know, we researched it and we went there and we let them know that they were discriminating. If they did, they fire him, we were gonna sue them. You know, we had Lambda call them. You know, we had lawyers call them and put a little of the fear of God in them. You know, and they finally don't do what they would have done if we weren't there.
Did you march that first year after you joined Gold? Did you march in the parade?
Yes, I did. It was a little scary, but before, it was scary before I marched. Once you get into the parade, you know, you're so proud and you feel so good because the cops get a pretty good reception from the crowd. We always get applauded and people pretty much like to see us there. So once you start marching, you feel really proud and really good. And but before the parade, it was a little scary, you know, thinking about I was going to be seen by everybody, you know. And even though, I mean, it's like the process I was telling you about, you know, coming to one person is easier, and then two people, and then three, and then, but you know, being in a fucking big crowd like that, it was really scary for me. But I marched, and it was over. I mean, once you get into the march, all the fears are gone.
Mm-hmm. What year was that again?
What year was that?
Yeah.
Gee.
Maybe John Gold.
Maybe 86. Yeah, I think it was 86 or 87. I had a year and a half probation. So I figured it would be, let's see, July 89, about the end of 86, or maybe the beginning of 87.
So, talk about the Puerto Rican Day Parade.
I was, once I get involved in the lesbian and gay community, I started a group. I didn't start a group. I joined a group called Boricua Gay and Lesbian Forum, which is a group of Puerto Rican lesbian and gay people. And we were doing pretty radical things. You know, we wanted to get to educate the Puerto Rican community about, or the Hispanic community about lesbian and gay issues, and also educate the lesbian and gay Hispanics about lesbian and gay issues and history. And we did a few radical things, you know, like going to conferences, Hispanic conferences, and we set up a booth and give out condoms we would write a legislative agenda, you know, send it to Albany and things like that, you know.
What kinds of things are you
doing? HIV, AIDS issues, you know, spending domestic partnership laws, worker rights, you know, benefits like bereavement benefits for workers, city workers and state workers, health benefits for lesbian and gay couples, things like that. Mm-hmm. And we decided, actually I came up with the idea. I said, why don't we march in a Puerto Rican Day Parade? I just came out as an idea, you know. I really didn't think we were going to do it so quickly. Everybody liked the idea, and we decided to march. And we did march. We put in for a permit. I got a word through one of the people that works in there with the organizer of the parade that they weren't going to give us a permit. They weren't going to allow us to march. And what I did was that I called the head of the parade. At that time, it was a woman. And I told her that we had been talking to our lawyers, you know, and of course we didn't have any fucking lawyers or nothing. It was just a bluff. And we had been talking to Landa Legal Defense and Education Fund, and we had been talking to, and they told us that if we didn't get a permit, we were going to put an injunction on the parade, and it wasn't going to be a parade. About a week later, we get the permit to march. They sent us a letter saying that we can march. And we got a coalition of different groups. We invited ACT UP, and we invited we really invited every group, you know. We wanted to have a lot of people there, and we weren't expecting a lot of Hispanics to show up, so we just decided to go for the numbers. Mm-hmm. And we received the permit to march. By that time, we had organized a kind of a little coalition of people, you know, La Buenas Amigas and Hispanic United Lesbians and Gays and all the other groups that were, all the Latino groups, lesbian and gay groups that we had then. There were about three or four. And other groups, such as AIDS organizations like ACT UP and all the many other groups. Anyway, they put us, our place in the parade was like at the end, totally at the end. And we waited for hours and hours and hours, and I think was that the first year that we just decided not to wait at be at the end, and we just went ahead, and the first year was right.
I know you did it the second year. Right?
Yeah, the first year too. We just we got tired of waiting, you know, so we just decided to kind of go ahead a little bit. We just went ahead of a lot of other groups, and we marched.
Just jumped in.
Yeah, just jumped into the parade, you know, when it was.
And about how many people were there? And what year?
The first year? I'd say about 75 people.
Uh-huh.
But then we ended up with about 150 because the gay people would join, you know, gay people from that were watching would join the parade. We had a couple of drag queens join the march. And it was funny because when we would get to St. Patrick's Cathedral, the cardinal was always there, you know, watching the parade and giving his blessings, whatever bullshit. And whenever they would see us coming, everybody, all the cardinal with all his cronies would go into the church. And then when we would pass, then they would come back out. And the television cameras, whenever we would pass by, they would go into commercials. They never showed us. They didn't show us for the first 2 years on TV.
And what was the reaction of people on the side?
I'd say it was half and half. You know, most people were silent. You know, they were just couldn't believe it. They just were looking, and half of the people that did have a reaction were positive, were like clapping and yeah. And the other half were like, boo, yeah, get off here, you fags, you know, Spanish. But it was good. I was expecting much worse, you know, so I felt good at the end of the parade. I was expecting rocks and getting my ass kicked, you know what I mean? Because we had heard that some years back before that a group had tried to march, and they weren't allowed to finish the parade because everybody got so angry, you know, that they had to stop them from march. It wasn't true. The years back, a group had done that. They never put in for a permit. They never asked for a permit. They just marched with a socialist group, with a banner, with a lesbian and gay banner. But they did complete the march, and they finished. It's just that we believe that hadn't happened, so we were a little afraid, you know. But nothing happened, no violent encounters or any of that. We finished and we all went home.
Mm-hmm.
The second year, we had the same problem with being relegated to the end of the parade. And the third year, we had the same problem. Every year, we just cut in like through the half of the parade and just go through.
Mm-hmm.
The second year, we didn't get any television coverage either. The third year, we did. Because this commentator, who's very open-minded, was given the job of commentating about the parade on TV. And when the gay group was coming, she started talking about the gay group. I mean, once she was talking about it, they couldn't just cut off and go into commercials. So they got caught the whole thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
on TV.
What about press coverage?
The first year, we got negative press coverage from the Hispanic papers. One Hispanic paper, El Vocero, said that there were some elements how do you say that in English? There were some undesirable elements of the marching. They never mentioned lesbian or gay or anything like that, but they said there were some undesirable elements marching, and they were going to be more careful who they let to march next year, the parade and something like that. I'm a little worried now because, you know, the St. Patrick's parade is being sued. The Hibernians are being sued by the Irish Lesbian and Gay Organization. And their basis for the lawsuit is that the parade is a public accommodation, so they cannot be discriminated against, because that goes against New York City laws. If the Hibernians win in court, and the judge decides that a parade is not a public accommodation, then the Hibernians can actually deny ILGO the permission to march. If that happens, that sets a legal precedent, you know. And I don't know if the organizers of the Puerto Rican Day Parade are going to come out and say, oh, we don't have to let them march, so we don't want them to march, you know, so you don't march in this year, which is going to start another whole problem for the Hispanic, lesbian, and gay people. But then maybe they won't. Maybe even with a court order, they would allow us to march. Or maybe there won't be a court order. Who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? We have to wait and see.
Do you think the Irish gay and lesbian group got the idea to march from the third region?
Oh, definitely. You know, we started the process. We were the first ones to go through with something like that, officially go and put in for a permit and march and a banner and everything. And then after us, the Gay Men of African Descent did it, and the African American Day Parade up in Harlem. And then the third group that did it was ELGO, the Irish Lesbian and Gay Organization. Yeah, I think it all started because we started the ball rolling. We did took the first step and did it first.
So what other kinds of things have you been doing? Do you want to talk about your campaign?
Mm-hmm. I ran for city council in 1991, last year. I didn't make it to the ballot because of the arcane laws of New York City. Jerry Brown and Paul Songhees are having a problem with the laws here now, and I'm so glad, because it's going to show the whole country how backwards we are here in terms of allowing people to run, you know. Actually, the Board of Elections just came out with a decision. They're going to allow them to run. But by that decision, they couldn't have reached this if they would have gone through the letter of the law. The decision was being some kind of a dealing behind the scene that the Songhees and the Brown people did with the Board of Elections. Because if they would have gone through the letter of the law, like they do with every other minor candidate, they don't want to go into the... They don't want to have a possibility of being elected, huh?
What is the law?
Oh, the election law of New York State. It's like an inch and a half thick book, you know, with rules. It's the worst and the most cumbersome process in the whole country. This is the worst of the whole country, you know. It's the hardest for anybody to get on the ballot from the whole country.
Give a few examples.
For example, in order to get on the ballot, you have to collect petitions. You have to collect so many signatures of registered Democrats within the district, you know, or registered Republicans within that district, depending on what party you belong to. And those signatures have to be perfect. I mean, like if you use green ink instead of black, you know, that's out of the window. Like. If the person prints their name instead of signing it, it's out of the window. The signature's not good. If they really cannot understand the signature, then it's out of the window too, because they won't be able to go through the buffer cards and check the signature. So it's really ridiculous. I mean, it was put in place by incumbents who don't want to be challenged. It's really a ridiculous, stupid law, you know. But it's been used very effectively by them. They have been using it to get rid of people they don't want to get on the ballot. That's what happened to me.
How many signatures did you collect?
I think it was 1,200, and I needed 900. It's just that they go one by one, and you know whatever they have at least about 16 different conditions. You know, of each one of the signatures have to meet, and if one of them didn't meet one of the conditions, the signature was out of the window. You know, it's not good. And that's how they got me on the ballot. But now I know the trick, you know. Now I know the law. Now I know this election was a trial run, really. I mean, I wanted to make it on the first one, but I really didn't have much of an expectation I was going to make it. It was a good experience. I would do it again, even if knowing what the outcome was going to be, because I learned a lot of things. You know, I learned who's going to be there for you, who's not going to be there for you. I learned that the lesbian and gay community is definitely not ready for lesbian and gay candidates, you know. Especially people of color candidates.
Yeah, well, you ran at the same time as Tom Duane and Sabson.
Yeah, and Antonio Pagan and Phil Reed and a few other candidates that were in the closet.
But Tom Duane and Sabson got all the attention.
Oh, they did, because they were running in the village, you know, with the... which is supposed to be the gay neighborhood, plus they're white, you know, and they had the contacts. They got all the attention from all the people. One of the things that I really thing that drew my campaign from the beginning was the outweek when I had a picture before, about the same week that I started to run, you know. I think that if outweek would have been there, the New York Lesbian and Gay magazine, it would have been different. The whole thing would have been a different ball game, because they would have been there to report to the lesbian and gay community what was going on, and to get the word out there, you know, what the situation of the different campaigns was.
What made you want to run?
It was a combination of things, you know. My neighborhood is going down the drain. And in the Morrisania area in the Bronx, Morrisania. I noticed that we weren't getting the services, you know, that other neighborhoods get. Like, if I would call the prison to make a complaint or to, if I would call, and I'm a cop, you know, I would get a lot of run around, and I would never get. I have a neighbor who has a scanner, you know, and half of the jobs that we call in the building don't, the cops never come, and they put over the radio that they did come, you know, things like that, you know. People are getting real shitty treatment from the police in my neighborhood. And we know that if those same cops were working on the Upper East Side, they would behave in a different manner with the people. Whenever you would call the prison, you know, you would get an attitude from the people there. Things like that, you know, there's a lot of graffiti in the neighborhood, there's a lot of drugs, there's a lot of crime. When I was campaigning, I would hear the same story over and over. You know, people were afraid for the kids, you know. People were tired of hearing guns going off in the middle of the night, you know, or machine guns outside of the buildings, you know. And people were moving out. And that moved me to run. Also, I was also moved because I wanted to have increase the amount of lesbian and gay people in the city council, you know, increase the power, political power of the lesbian and gay community. So I think those were the two basic reasons.
And you are thinking of running again?
Yeah, I'm thinking of running again in 93. I don't know if I'm going to run in my district, the district that I have now. I don't know that. I'm looking into other districts. Depends on a lot of things, you know. I have to see if there's going to be another redistricting. This, because the mayor said last time that they were going to do it again. I doubt it, but if something like that is going to happen, I have to look into that and decide then. I don't think my political aspirations are over yet, but I got to take a lot of things into consideration, you know, before I decide where to run and if I'm going to run at all. I think I will, but that's not 100% sure.
And so more about goals, do you go to meetings once a month?
Yeah, we have our meetings the second Tuesday of the month at the Lesbian and Gay Community Center. And what we do in the meetings is that we usually invite some kind of an expert on a field that's related to lesbian and gay people, say a tax expert or a lawyer that deals with lesbian and gay adoptions or a lawyer that deals with lesbian and gay wills and things like that. We want to educate our members, you know, about their rights and about how to better prepare for difficult times, you know. Also, we have people of the different communities of color, like gay men of African descent. We had the head of the organization there once. He was talking about racism. We had women groups come and talk about abortion and talk about women rights, things of that nature. We have gone from an organization that dealt only with lesbian and gay issues to an organization that really want to improve the standing of people of color, you know, and women and the disabled. We're not only dealing with lesbian and gay issues, but also other issues, you know, other isms that affect society these days.
Mm-hmm. How many members then?
The last count, it was 1250, something like that.
And how many are out?
I'll say about 50% of the people are out now. There's somebody was telling me a story the other day. One of our sergeants is a board member, and was in his prison. He was taking care of the desk. He was a desk officer for that day. And something happened that he said he's thinking about a year and a half ago, maybe a year ago would have never happened, you know, 2 years ago. One of the other members came into the prison and told him, "Sarge, do I give you the dues for gold, or I give it to my deputy director?" You know, in front of everybody, and it's like any other society now, you know, like the Hispanic society or any other society. And something that wouldn't never happen 2 years back, you know, when everybody was in the closet, because it couldn't happen. We didn't have a face. Now it's different. Now we're making big strides, you know.
What are some things you think we will do in the future?
In the future? We are now educating these cops, you know, about lesbian and gay people. And we don't educate them by giving them a class, sitting them down and giving them a class, you know. We educate them by being there, you know. They realize that we're not much different from them when they get to work with us and spend 8.5 hours a day in a patrol car or spend 8.5 hours a day working a bit, you know. They realize that that we're not much different. We just want the same things, you know. And we break the stereotypes, you know. We're doing that now, and it's going to be done in a greater scale as we grow. Because we're not only going to be in the village and in Manhattan. We're also expanding to the other boroughs, you know, Brooklyn and Queens, Staten Island, and so we're growing in the department. We're growing. More people are coming out of the closet. More people are joining GOAL. And we're going to reach the amount of people that we should have, which is about 10% of the department, you know. I think once we have about 3,000 or 4,000 members, then I'll be comfortable, you know, with the numbers. And we also want to expand in the nation, you know. We have right now we have 12 chapters around the U.S. We have 2 in Europe and 1 in Puerto Rico. And we want to get bigger in that sense, you know. We want to have more chapters. So the message is heard by everybody, you know. So every police department in this nation knows that they're gay, lesbian and gay people out there, you know. And once they realize that the brutality that lesbian and gay people receive from the police departments is going to disappear slowly, you know. Slowly, it will slowly disappear, because once the cops get to know us, they're not stupid, you know. They realize that we're just people. And they pretty much will leave us alone.
What's the impact of AIDS been on GOAL?
We have lost a few members to AIDS. It's very difficult for a lesbian and gay police officer to come out to the department and tell them that he has AIDS, you know. And it's especially difficult when you're in the closet and you have AIDS. Or you're HIV positive. We have cases where some people will even go as far as pay for AZT themselves. Because if they get it through the plan, then the job would know that they're taking AZT, and everybody would know they're HIV positive. And it's a big expense, you know. We're talking about $1,000 a month or something like that. And a lot of people, we had a few people that were so closeted and so afraid of being found out, that they would pay for the medicines with from their own pockets, you know, even though they could get it to the job for free, so their medical plan for free. It really hasn't affected the organization much, you know. Like none of our board members have been are HIV positive or have any. I mean, we all know people that have died of AIDS, and in that sense, we are affected, but. No, it hasn't affected the organization on a great scale, like it has done to other lesbian and gay organizations, where they lose half of the members of the board, and they lose a lot of the talents.